Okay, we're beginning here, seven lines down on the top of Samechei Amud Aleph. The Gemara is continuing the discussion about the machloka between Rav and Shmuel as to how to paskin in this machloka between Rabbi Kiva and the Chachamim. Rabbi Kiva thinks that mocher ba'ein yafa mocher, that a seller sells in the most generous manner, whereas the Chachamim believe that a person sells in the most miserly fashion, ba'ein ra'ah mocher. And we saw yesterday, Rav paskin like the Chachamim, that ba'ein ra'ah mocher, and Shmuel paskin like Rabbi Akiva that be'ain yafa mocher. Amar le Ravina le Ravashi, lema azdu lutamayu. Let us say that Rav and Shmuel over here in this machloket upcoming are also going l'shitata. The Amar of Nachman, Amar Shmuel. Nachman says in the name of Shmuel, achin shechalku en lehem lo derech zelze velo sulamot zelze velo chanonot zelze velo amatamayim zelze v'hizharu behen shalachot kibuel tein. When brothers split up the Yerusha, the estate that they received from their father, when they split up the properties between them, they have no residual rights in order to utilize the space of the other brother. So for instance, in the first case where we have two brothers splitting the fields, and there's one outer field and one inner field, and the inner field needs to traverse the outer field in order to get out or to access that field that is captive to the outer field, when they split the properties, Lo derech ze al ze. Neither of them has a right to demand access or the right to traverse the property. In essence, we're saying that the mocher sells be'ayin yafa, and therefore he gives away all rights. We'll discuss that in 1 second, because obviously both of them are sellers over here. Below sulamot ze al ze, we saw this earlier in the Masechta back on Zayin Amud Bet. Over there, there was a machloka between the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot as to what the meaning of lo sulamot zel zeh is. The Rashbam says that if one of the brothers took the upper house, or the aliyah, and the other brother took the house below in the chatzer, then the individual doesn't have a right to put stairs or a ladder in the chatzer to get up to his aliyah. The Balei Tosafot rejected that because they said that that's synonymous with the case of derech, that you don't have a right to traverse the other person's property to get access to your property. So they believe that En lehem sulamot zel zeh is explained by a case where one individual took the upper house or upper chamber and the chatzer, and the other person took the bayit, the lower house. In order to access his aliyah from the chatzer below, both of which belong to him, he needs to put a staircase, he puts a ladder between them, but he's got to rest that ladder on the lower individual's house. What we're saying here is that he does not have permission, or he doesn't have the right to lean the ladder on the other brother's ownership of that lower house in order to gain access to his house. Lo chalonot zelze, you don't have a right if you have a window with adjacent properties that if you then split the property, it doesn't give you light rights or the easement that allows you to keep the light coming in there. If the other party decides to put up a wall and block the light coming into your house, that's fine, because while you took this property or this house that included windows, you did not take the right to maintain the windows or maintain the light access of these windows because you sold b'ayin yafa. Lo matamayim zelzeh. If one of the fields needs a water channel to traverse the other field in order to get to his field, he doesn't have a right to demand the other field allow the water to go through. So according to Shmuel, when they divide the property, and it's clear here, this is a machloket that we'll see later on in the Masechta, as to whether when brothers divide up the estate, they're considered to be like lukuchot, like buyers, or they consider it to be yorshim, and therefore they're just determining retroactively which piece of the property came to them as part and parcel of the Yerusha. So here it's clear that the Gemara is viewing this kilukuchot damim, that they are like buyers. If they're like buyers, it'll be governed by the same rules that we saw from Yekiva the Chachamim before, which is that you have one buying and one selling. And therefore we look at each property and say that it was sold ve'ayin yafa. When sold ayin yafa, the person who's selling doesn't maintain for himself any residual rights. And that's why, over here, none of the brothers have any claim against the other brother for those residual rights, or those easements, either for access for light, or for the ability to utilize their field in a proper manner. None of those rights come along with the sale. Now, the Rashbam points out here that in any one of these cases, there are two parties. There is a seller and a buyer, but vice versa, the other party is also selling and buying. So why over here do you say that mocher ba'ayin yafa, mocher, and he loses all his rights, why don't you say the other brother sold it to him and gave him all his rights? So the Rashbam notes over here that there's a difference. For instance, in the case where you have an inner field that is captive and an outer field, then the owner, the brother with the inner field, sold the outer field to the other brother. In selling it, he sold that b'ayin yafa. He sold it in the most generous manner, which did not grant him access rights, or he gave up his access rights. And then the brother on the outside, he bought that field from his brother. He was not a seller. And therefore, as a buyer, it won't have any impact over here because it's the seller that governs with regards to these situations. If you say then that the person on the outer field, he sold the inner field to his brother, he didn't withhold any rights when he sold him the inner field. Because vis-a-vis the inner field, he gave him everything that was associated with the inner field. He just, on the outer field, kept whatever was there. But in terms of maintaining for himself any residual rights from the inner field, he didn't do that. So therefore, the Rashbam believes that aval gabei chitzon lo shayach ayin ra'a b'mesh enu noten lo et derech she'enu mocher b'sadeh zo achitzon elo lokeach. Because as far as the outer field is concerned, he's a buyer, not a seller. And therefore, by lokeach, there's no din of ayin yafa. And by the sadeh p'nimi, havihu mocher shemachar l'achiv chelko. As far as the inner field, where he sold it to his brother, when he sold him the inner field, he didn't leave anything residual to himself. He sold him the entire inner field. That's the way that the Rishbam explains it. Rishonim, like the Tosafot read, point out that they think that this is a game of semantics that the Rishbam is playing over here by saying that one party is considered to be the buyer and not the seller, and by one, we consider the right and not the other one. And therefore, they come up with a different solution than the Rashbam. They have different nuances of it, but basically it is that when you have two parties that are competing against each other, then in that sense, they both have this concept of ayin yafa mocher. And when you have those competing interests bumping up against each other, then we say each person gets exactly what they bought, that property, and nothing beyond that, no rights beyond that. Because of the offsetting nature of the ayin yafa, we just say that you get exactly what you bought, and nothing in the other person's property. And that obviously would assume here that these transactions are happening simultaneously. By the case of Yusha, it's easy to see that, but even in other situations where a person sells to both parties, we're going to see that in the upcoming Gemara, you would have to say that it happens in a simultaneous manner, because then you can have this offsetting ayin yafa. On the other hand, if one of them took before the other, or it wasn't done simultaneously, then obviously the first person that was the seller would be giving up rights because he'd be mocher yafa, and the second seller would then only have to deal with whatever was the status quo at that time. But in the case of Yerusha, where they are splitting up the property, it's by design, it's going to be simultaneous. And therefore, these Rishonim believe, unlike the Rashbam, who thinks that there's a difference between the different parties here, and therefore you end up with this result, they just say that each party has this mocher ba'ayin yafa. Those offset each other, and in offsetting each other, we go to the minimum of what was divided up, and that means the exact property you got is what you got. You got no rights beyond that. What you see here, according to Shmuel, is that mocher b'ayin yafa mocher, and this is similar to his shita that he paskins like Rabbi Akiva. Rav Amar Yishlehem. Rav disagrees with this and says that they do have rights, and that would be Rav the Shita To, who says mocher b'ayin ra'a mocher, and therefore he does leave those rights to the other party. And therefore, in all of these cases, whether it was the derech, the sulam, the amatamayim, in all those cases, you would have left the right to the other brother. So this is what Ravina is pointing out to Ravashi, that it seems here that the machlok between Rav and Shmuel in the case of Yerusha seems to parallel their machloket when it comes to the issue of ayin ra'a and yayin yafa mocher. And Ravashi responds to him and says, tzricha, you need both of these cases. Ein hochanami, that they are of a similar nature, but they're not exactly alike. And because they're not exactly alike, you could not extrapolate from one to the other. And so the Rashbam points out that even though many times in the Gemara itself says, Azdu l'tamayu, it brings a machloket of a similar nature between Amoraim and Tanaim, and then afterwards we'll say Tzricha, and we'll say, why is there a duplication of the machloket? Because you couldn't extrapolate from one to the other. Over here, because of the nature of the way the Gemara is flowing, the Rashbam points out that this is the statements of the Amoraim here and not the statements of the Stam Gemara. Because Ravina mentioned to Ravashi that he thought that this machloket was similar in nature. And now Ravashi is responding to him and saying, yes, it might be of a similar nature, but it's not exactly alike. And therefore, Tzricha, you need both machlokot. That could be for one of two reasons. Either, yes, they both deal with Ayin Ra and Ayin Yafa, but it's not exactly the same, and therefore you couldn't extrapolate from one to the other. Or you could argue in the other case, which we will see later in the Masech, that it's possible that the issue there is completely different, and therefore you can't say, Azdu the Tamayu. Diya Shmeinim Bahahi, because if you only told me about this case by the Yerusha, Bahai Kamar Rav, over there, that's why Rav says it, Mishum Damalei, being on the Meidar Bay, Kehechi Didaru Bay Avatai, because he can make a claim that I want to utilize the property, or the house, or whatever that he took in Yerusha, I want to utilize it the same way our father utilized it. And therefore, it should come along with the rights that our father had. If our father owned both of the fields, then he had access to both of the fields. And that means when I take the captive field or the inner field, I should also have the right to access the field, just like our father had access to the field because he owned both fields. Just because you now own the other field doesn't curtail my ability to use the field like our father did. And therefore, I have rights of traversing over there. So that would be unique to a case of Yerusha, whereby there is precedent as to how the father accessed the property or how the father used the property. And given that, he would say, Rav, in that case, that you don't give up those rights, Teda. You should know that that's the case. The Gemara says, Dichtiv, Tachad Avotecha, Yuvanecha, that the children step into the shoes of the father, or in essence, they take over the rights of the father, and therefore that would be a good logic to apply in that case. So it might be unique to the case of Yerusha, according to Rav, because the children step the shoes of the father. You could go even one step further and say that this is Rav the Shitato, is Machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Rav later on the Masechta, as to whether Achim Shechalku, when the brothers divide up the Yerusha, are they considered like the Kuchot, or are they considered to be Yerushim? And Rav is of the opinion that they are considered to be Yerushim, so it might be even more fundamental than that, that Rav doesn't agree that they are the Kuchot in this case, and therefore there's nothing to speak about in terms of Ayin Yafah and Ayin Ra'ah, because it's not a case of Michira and Lekicha. So you could even read further into the statement of the Gemara here. But even if you leave it on a superficial basis, which is that Rav just thinks that this case might be exceptional, Aval Baha, you might have suggested in the case of the Machloket Rabbi Kiva and the Chachamim, where you're talking about a regular transaction, there maybe Rav agrees, Ema Modile de Shmuel. He'll agree with Shmuel that the halacha is like Rabbi Kiva, that Mocher Ba'ain Yafa Mocher. V'it Mar Baha, if you talk about the cases like in our Mishnah, where you're talking about an Ayin Ra'ah and an Ayin Yafa by the Mocher, maybe over there, that's where Shmuel paskins like Rabbi Kiva, that a mocher is ba'ayin yafa mocher aval baha. In the case of Yerusha, ema modile de Rav. Maybe he would agree with Rav's position over there because of the uniqueness of the case of children inheriting the father, where the children take over the rights of the father, or they step into the shoes of the father and should be able to utilize the property the way their father did. Given that mitigating claim, that maybe over there we would not say mocher ba'ayin yafa mocher. And he would then agree to Rav's position. Tzricha, therefore you need both machlokot to teach us that either in the machloket by Yerusha, that they do maintain their positions, despite the fact that that case is different, or to tell us that maybe that case has nothing to do with Ayin Yafa and Ayin Ra, but has to do with the way that you view the children vis-a-vis the father. And so do you view them as the kuchot? Do you view them as Yerushim? And that would also influence how you would paskin in that case, independent of how you felt about Ayin Ra'ah or Ayin Yafah. And so for that reason, the Gemara needs to explain to us the machloket of Rav and Shmuel over here, as well as over there. Amalei Rav Nachman, the Rav Huna. So Rav Nachman says to Rav Huna, Hilchato Kavatin, is the locha like us, or Hilchato Kavataychu, or is the locha like you? So as far as Rav Huna is concerned, we saw before that Rav Huna Marav, Rav Huna is a Talmud of Rav, quoted the locha in the name of Rav, which is Alocha Kedivrei Chachamim. We know that Rav Nachman, as the Rishpam says over here, and so does the Rabbeinu Gershom, was a Talmid of Shmuel. As we see over here, he quotes, Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Shmuel. And given that he's a Talmid of Shmuel, he's saying, is the halacha like us? Because Shmuel said that the halacha is like Rabbi Akiva, that mocher ba'ayin yafa mocher. So his question is the halacha like the Chachamim? Or is the halacha like Rabbi Akiva? Or in essence, is the halacha like Rav, who paskins like the Chachamim? Or is the halacha like Shmuel, who paskins like Rabbi Akiva? The Rabbeinu Gershom seems to even indicate that it's possible he was saying this because of that statement of Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel. He brought Achim Shechalku. And if we say that, like Ravina, that that is the same machloket that we have over here, then it would be clear that Rav Nachman also has that position. Not just that he's saying my Rebbe Shmuel had that position, but he's quoting Shmuel in a case where achim shechalku, and therefore that shows that that Rav Nachman himself holds like that. Or the last possibility is that Rav Nachman lived in the city of Narada, which was the city of Shmuel, and then the assumption is that Rav Nachman followed that position of Shmuel. But given that, he wants to know, is the halacha like you, which is like Rav, that the halacha will be like the chachamim by in Rav Yira'a, or is the halacha like us, which is that the halacha is like Shmuel, like Rabbi Akiva, that ba'ayin yafa mocher. Amalei yukhata kavataychu, the halacha is like you. It's unusual. Rav Huna says, despite the fact that I have this Mesorah from my Rebbe Rav, and despite the fact that I hold like that, the halacha should follow you, Rav Nachman, the mekarvitu lebava deresh galuta, because you are close to the gateway or the doorways of the Resh Galuta, the Shechichei Dayine, where there is many cases that are brought, or many Dayanim that sit. And that is because Rav Nachman was the son-in-law of the Resh Galuta. He was also a Dayan, as we'll see in the Gemara in Shavuot. And therefore the Gemara favors Paskei Halacha like Rav Nachman in these cases because of his exposure to case law. In the situation of the Resh Galuta, that was where the majority of cases were brought, because in the Jewish cities, they were given autonomy in terms of their adjudication and court systems, and therefore the Resh Galuta could enforce the Pesak Halacha of the courts. And then, so that made those courts the central location for people to bring adjudications. And that means that Rav Nachman saw either a lot of cases or many Dayanim sitting there and paskening the cases, and given that exposure, he knows what the halacha should be like, and he saw what the halacha was paskin. And so therefore, we should follow you, Rav Nachman, or you, or Mesora, because you have that exposure. And that's what we say in general in the Gemara, that halacha ki Rav Nachman bedine, that halacha follows Rav Nachman in those cases that deal with case law or adjudications, because of this unique standing of Rav Nachman. And Rav Huna is acknowledging that over here. Itmar, shnei batim, ze lifnei mizeh. You have two houses, one that is inside of the other, meaning that one is captive to the other. Shnehem b'mecher, shnehem b'matana. If the individual sold both of them to two different parties, or he gifted them to two different parties, ein lehem derech zel zeh. Neither of them has a claim on the other, because we can say that mocher b'machar b'ayin yafa, or a notain gives a matana b'ayin yafa, but applies equally to both parties. So just like he gave generously to the inner party, the captive house, he also gave that generously to the outer house. And that means that they each individually get the property that they're entitled to, but neither of them has a claim against the other. And that would be most important for the captive property, that he does not have access rights just because it was sold to him or gifted to him, because the other party also received those same rights at the same time. And the person was generous to both. We're not going to make him generous to one on the back of the other, or at the expense of the other. Now, again, this is what I mentioned before. This would obviously have to happen simultaneously. Koshikain, chitzon b'matana, upnibi b'mecher. Certainly a case where he sold the inner house, the captive house, to a party, and he gifted the outer house to another party. And certainly over there, the inner house has no rights on the outer house, because as we're going to see in a second, that when a person gifts something, they're even more generous than when they sell it. And so given that, it's certain in that case that the outer house can block any rights that the inner house would think to have, or traverse rights or easement rights that they would have. And therefore, the inner party gets the house, but no access rights to that house. On the other hand, chitzon b'mecher upnimi b'matana, in a case where he grifted the inner property and he sold the outer property, sover mina, we would have thought to say, ein lehem derech zel zeh. This would be the same halacha that we've seen all along, which is that when the transactions happen simultaneously, irrespective of whether it's a matana or mecher, the person gifts in the most generous manner, and that means that each party will get their property, but neither of them will have rights on each other, and most importantly, that's for the captive property, will not have a right to access his property through the outer property. And we would think it would be in any of these permutations. The Gemara is certain where both of them were sold to, or both of them were gifted to, or in a case where the outer one was gifted and the inner one was sold, in that case, the Gemara is certain that they have no rights on each other. The Gemara says over here that in the case where the outer party was sold to and the inner party was gifted to, I would have thought this would be the same din as all the other cases here, and they have no rights on each other. Velohi, but that's incorrect. Milo Tnan, don't we have a Mishnah later on in Daf Ayin Aleph, Bamed Varim Amurim? When is this true that you have this machloke between the Chachamim and Rabbi Akiva as to whether a mocher is b'ayin yafa or ayin ra'a mocher? B'mocher, that's when they're selling. Aval benotein matana, when a person gifts, notein et kulan, then he gifts the most generous manner. So even the chachamim who disagree with regards to mechira, that a person sells be'ayin ra'ah, they agree by a matana that he gifts in the most generous manner. Alma man de'yav matana ba'ayin yafa yahiv. So there we see from that a person who gives in a more generous manner. Even the chachamim would disagree by mecher, agree by matana that that's the case. Hachanami, so to over here, man de'yav matana ba'ayin yafa yahiv. So to over here, with regards to Rabbi Akiva, even if you believe that the mocher is mocher ba'ayin yafa, the one who gives a matana gives it with even more ayin yafa. And so therefore, in our case over here, where he sold the outer property and gifted the inner property, that means that the inner property should get more than the outer property. Once you've said that, then the inner property maintains the right to traverse through the outer property or the easement over the outer property because he got a gift, which is more generous than a sale. And that means that the seller or gifter over here would favor him over the outer property. And that would mean that he would maintain the rights of access and he would not have to purchase a derech to access the property that he was gifted. Okay, now the next Mishnah continues. A mocheret abayit, person who sells a house, macharet adelet, he sells the door that comes with the house, because in seeing a second that things that are mechubar to the house, that are attached to the house, belong to the house. Avaloet amafteach, but not the key, because the key is considered to be metaltolin, something that is carried out, something that is not attached to the house. We'll have to discuss exactly what that means in mafteach. We'll discuss that in the Gemara. But the key element or the key difference over here is whether the item is mechubar lekarka, is attached to the ground or attached to the house, versus something that is metaltel. Macharet amachteshet hakvua, he sells a mortar that is attached to the ground, avalavet amitaltelet, but not a mortar that is movable or not attached to the ground. Macharet aitstrovil, avaloet akelet, he sells, these are different parts of the mill, and the Rishonim here disagree about exactly what it means that the Yitzrobil and the Kelet. If you look in the Rashbam, he says that the Yitzrobil is the base upon which the mill sits. So it's not the mill stones, the lower mill stone or upper mill stone, but the base itself upon which you put the mill itself. And that is a fixture in the house, something that you don't take away. Of a Loet, a Kelet, he says the Kelet is the equivalent of a hopper. Kelet also means a basket, but it is the mechanism by which you feed the kernels of wheat into the mill. And so that is clearly metaltel. That's something that moves around. It can be taken on and off of the mill. And so that clearly does not go with the house. There are others that suggest that the Yitzrobel and the Kelet are describing the two millstones, and that the Yitzrobel is the lower millstone, which is fixed in place, whereas the Kelet is the upper millstone that goes around the lower millstone, and might even include within it the hopper that allows the wheat to go in, because it's shaped like an hourglass on the way that it sits on the lower millstone, and therefore it's something that is movable or removable, and that's why it's not sold along with the house. Because the Rambam thinks the Kelet is either some sort of protective fence that doesn't allow the flour to shoot out of the mill, or it's a collection bucket down below that captures the flour that comes out of the mill. But the key element of difference, once again, is that the strobel is much more of a fixture, and therefore it'll go along with the house, but not the kelet, which is an item that is movable or removable, and therefore would not be sold along with the house. Velo et tanur, velo et kiraim, nor the oven, nor the stove is included in the sale. You can see here in the Rashbam that there were differences in girsot. According to the Rashbam, this is the girsa that's proper for our Mishnah, and it's the way that it's found in Tosefta as well. But he says, B'seder Mishnah garas machar tanur machar kiraim, that the oven and the stove do go along with the sale. And he says, V'lo nihira, he thinks that that's incorrect. B'mita, if you do have that girsa, tzarich lokma b'mechubar dekarka, you have to set up the case that they're attached or fixed to the ground, and therefore the difference in the Mishnah will be how the oven and stove are placed in the house. If they are movable, then they would not go along with the house. If they were fixtures or fixed to the ground, then they would be sold with the house. That's the way the Rashbam learns it. If you look in the Bali HaTosafot, they suggest that both Girsaot believe that the Tanur and Kiraim here are fixed to the ground. The question is, does that fixing it or affixing it to the ground make them part or parcel of the house? Because regards to the Dinei Tuma, the oven and the stove still are Mekabel Tuma, even after you plaster them to the ground. And so the question, or the machloket in the girsa, is how much is this similar to the dinei of tuma? If you say by dinei tuma that they're considered to be kelim and can be mekabel tuma, does that mean over here they're also classified as metaltalin and are not sold with the house? Or do we say that the dinim of the people selling and buying items, their perspective is different than the dinim of tuma? So yes, Ein Ochanami by Dine Tuma, it will be considered a Kli, but as far as transactions, there people look at them as being affixed to the ground because they're plastered into the ground, and therefore they would be sold along with the house. So now this is similar to in the modern day, depending on the country or the situation, the people believe that there are certain items when you sell the house that come along with the house. That include any fixtures that are attached to the ceiling, as well as the refrigerator and the washing machine and dryer. If they're not specifically excluded from the sale contract, then they are automatically included because they are considered to be fixtures of the house. And so similarly over here, there are certain items that are considered to be fixtures of the house that you can't walk off with. There are other items that are considered to be metaltalin and that you can walk off with. But if the bill of sale says that I'm buying everything that's in it, then everything is sold. That means that not only are the fixtures sold, but also the metaltalin, and vice versa. If you excluded the items that were attached, if you specify or stipulate that they're not included, then they aren't included in the sale. The Rishbam over here goes through a detail to explain that context makes a difference over here. Because when we say over here that they are sold, these are only items that are metaltalim that come along or quasi-fixtures of the house. It doesn't mean that all the clothes and all the other metaltalim that are in the house are sold along with the house. And so he says you have to look at the context. When a person sells their house, they likely want to keep their possessions. They're not trying to sell all their possessions. They're just selling the things that are connected to the house. So in a default situation, they would sell anything that's affixed to the ground because they can't take it out. In a situation when you stipulate that anything inside of it, it means anything that is a heavy work item or something that normally would be used in the house. But it doesn't mean your personal possessions that are in the house that also come along with the house, even though those are also classified as metaltalin. On the other hand, if you sell the chatzer, then if you say kol mashe b'tocho, anything in it, it would even include metaltalin, it would include your possessions over there, but it would exclude items like chita and tzora, and maybe behemot. But then if you sell the city, it would include even those items. And so what the Rishbam says, he phrases it in one of two ways here, is that either context matters, which is that the larger the item that you are selling, the more that is included in it, because then the items become smaller and smaller in reference or relationship to the sale, and therefore it's batel to the sale. So if you sell the house, you would sell only metaltalim that are really relevant or connected to the house. When you go to the chatzer, you include even more metaltalim. You go to the ear, which is a massive sale, then everything would be included in the sale because they are batel or they are so minute compared to the sale or the total price of the sale. So he says as you get to a bigger and bigger sale, more and more is included. Or the other way that he phrases it, you have to look at what the person is trying to do. In a case where a person is selling their house, doesn't mean that they're moving out of town. It might mean they're moving next door, they're moving somewhere nearby, and therefore they want to keep their possessions to move. When they sell the chatzer, that means that they're not only moving out of the house, but they're selling the chatzer, it makes it look like they're going on a long trip, and they're not going to want to take all this stuff with them. Therefore, more is included. They sell the city, that means they're totally giving up on any ownership. Therefore, they would sell even more because of the nature of the size of the sale. Not the size of the context, it's not the size itself inherently, but the context, which is you can see from the sale that this person doesn't intend to take these things with him. It's going to be too much of a bother to move the stuff to a far-flung place, and therefore they want to sell everything that's there. So depending on what they sell will indicate to us what their intent is in the future, whether they believe they're going to stay in the city or they're going to be nearby, whether they're selling for a much longer trip or a longer term, and therefore it would include more in the sale. So for one of those two reasons, the Rashbam says that there are different gradations, what's included when you say chomash b'tocho, even though they all seem to mean everything that's there, they don't always mean everything. You have to look at the particular case. The Gemara says, Lema matnitan to loka Rabbi Meir. Let us say that our Mishnah does not follow the position of Rabbi Meir. D, Rabbi Meir, if you think it follows Rabbi Meir, hamamar, he says later on in the Masechta, macharet akerem, macharet ashmishe kerem. You sell the vineyard, you sell all the items that are used to work in the vineyard. So now the items that we're speaking about here, all we shouldn't even point out, are the stakes and the trellises upon which you put the grapevines. And most of we shouldn't even point out that even if they're not attached to the ground now, they are just laying there. Nevertheless, they are considered to be a part and parcel of the vineyard. And when you sell the vineyard, you also sell those items that come along with it. So here you have, according to the Rashbam, here you have something that even though it's not attached to the ground, it nevertheless goes with the sale. But in our Mishnah, there's a distinction that's made between something that's attached and not attached, like the Machteshet. In the Mishnah, the Machteshet HaKvu'ah did not get sold with the property. Machteshet sheinu kvuah or miteltelet, that's not attached to the ground, doesn't go with the sale. So that would be in contrast or contradiction to Rabbi Meir's opinion, who says that by the kerem, even the items are not attached to the ground, but they are used with the kerem, they go along with the kerem. That's the way the Rashbam views the question. The Rabbeinu Gershom and the Balei Tosfot, on the other hand, see this as a question from the Mafteach, from the key, which is that by the case of the key, which is something that is normally utilized for this house, and the key is used to open up the lock, and therefore you would say that its utility is connected to the house. Therefore, it should be sold with the house. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says the Mafteach is accepted from the sale. That's unlike what Rabbi Meir says by the vineyard, that items that are normally used with the vineyard, they go along with the vineyard, and that's why it's irreconcilable between Rabbi Meir's opinion and our Mishnah. Gemara says, maybe not, afilu teimei Rabbi Meir, maybe even Rabbi Meir can be the author of our Mishnah, hatam kviya, hacha lo kviya. It has to do with the nature of the two items. Over there by the kerem, it's kviya. Now kviya can mean one of two things. Either it means that these stakes or these trellises are already in the ground, and therefore they're considered to be a part and parcel of the vineyard, or kviya over there can mean that these are items that are always used with the kerem. Nobody takes them out of the kerem because they are necessary props or necessary items to make the kerem into a vineyard. And therefore, they become part and parcel of the vineyard. And you can see that difference in the Rabbeinu Gershom, who says that in the kerem, the Hishmisham kvu'in bekarko, came into mechuber lekarko in kekarko. They have a din like karko because they're attached to the ground. But the Rashbam says, she'in mezizim otam isham, that you don't move them from there, the olam, afagav dein kvuim bekarka, even though they're not attached to the ground, there are items that don't move from that location. So this difference that we're describing is a machloka that you see here between the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam. Over here, that's not the case. It's either not kviya, which means that it's not attached to the ground, and therefore it's movable, that's why it has a different status, or hatam kviya is that people do, when the machteshet is not attached to the ground, they do lend it out to their neighbors. They do move it out of the house. It's not a permanent fixture of the house, and therefore it would be different. So even if you believe, like Rabbi Meir, by the vineyard, that that's the din, over here you could agree with our Mishnah. Gemara says, wait a minute, in our Mishnah, it contrasts the mafteach to the door. Ma delet de kviya, just like the door is attached, af mafteach de kviya. We're also speaking about a mafteach that is kviya, that is there. So now, depending on what you said kviya was before, the Gemara is now saying that this mafteach has that same definition. So if you said before that the stakes in the vineyard mean that they were planted in the ground, they are attached to the ground, so too the delet is attached to the wall, and the key is left inside of the locking mechanism all the time. And therefore it's considered to be attached to the house. Or if you say kviya, it means that it's regularly used in this way. They are part and parcel of the normal usage of the house. You can say the same thing here, but the delet, you need a door to have a house be a house. So too, you need a key to use the door and be able to lock the door and close the door. It's part and parcel of the normal use of the house, and people don't take the key out of the locking mechanism. Even though, like in our day where we take the key out, over there the key was the equivalent of the bolt, the way that you lock the door, not a way that you access the house, because it was from the inside of the house and it was used to lock the door. But in the end, they both agree that the solution of the Gemara here is to say that the Mafteach is permanently or always kept in the locking mechanism. For the Rashbam, that makes it that it is part and parcel of the normal utility of the house. It's Kavua Shama, therefore it has the same din as the Tashmishia Kerem. Or for the Rabbeinu Gershom, once it's left there on a permanent basis, it becomes attached to the door, attached to the house, and then therefore it becomes a part and parcel of the house because of its fact that it's affixed in that specific location, doesn't get taken out. So given that, it's classified as either kaviya, according to the Rashbam, or mechubar the karka, or mechubar the bayit, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom. And therefore, the key should have gone along with the house, according to Rabbi Meir the Shitato. Although the Rimi Gash does bring a different distinction, which is that the difference between the Havamin and the conclusion of the Gemara with regards to the Mafteach is that they originally thought that Mafteach was a generic key, equivalent today of a skeleton key, that would work on multiple houses or multiple locks. And therefore, they didn't think it was a part and parcel of the house. The conclusion of the Gemara is that just like the delet is kavua, we're talking about a mafteach kavua, which means that it's a key that is unique to this house. And that uniqueness makes it that it only works here and is only relevant to this house. Therefore, it belongs to the house. Now, once you've done that, makes it pretty clear that our Mishnah can't be like Rabbi Meir, because Mafteach in this case looks exactly like the situation of Tashmishei Kerem that Rabbi Meir described in the Braita later on. And therefore, just like over there, he thinks that Tashmishei Kerem go along with the Kerem. So it's over here, the Mafteach should have gone along with the house. The fact that our Mishnah says it doesn't go along with the house shows you that our Mishnah is not authored or it doesn't follow this position of Rabbi Meir. Tan Rabbanan, Amucheret Abayit, Macharet Adelet, Veta Nagar, Veta Man'ol. Person who sells a house, along with the house goes the doorway. The Nagar is some sort of latch. It's described here by the different Rishonim in different ways. Some say it's attached to the wall adjacent to the door and has a latch that goes across or some sort of bar that goes across that locks the door down. Or the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom describes it, it is behind Ubriach Shekavua Bekota Lamalo. That's on the wall above, in a delet, Shnuel a delet, Nofela Nagar Adaretz. That it's some sort of pin or peg that goes down and blocks the opening of the door. So it's some sort of bolting mechanism that's either attached above the door or to the side of the door. The Man'o is a lock that is put on the door itself. It's a locking mechanism that is a part of parcel of the door. It's not something that attaches it to the door frame and therefore locks it by being a latch of some sort, but rather it's a lock that is in the door itself. Avalo et ha-mafteach, but the key is not included in that. Machar et ha-mechteshet ha-chakuka, in the sale of the house, so too is included a mortar that is carved out of the bedrock of the house. Avalo et ha-kvua, on the other hand, a mortar that was first carved out and then later placed in, then that is not sold with the house, because even though it was put in after the fact, it's not considered to be a part and parcel of the house. We're explaining this according to the Rishbam. Later on, we'll see that the Balei Tosafot make a different distinction between Hachakuka and Hakvua to solve a problem. But right now, what we're saying is that a Machteshet that was attached later on is not part and parcel of the sale of the house. That makes it clear that the Tanakam over here cannot be the author of our Mishnah, because our Mishnah says that a Machteshet Hakvua does get sold with the house. And over here, we're saying it doesn't get sold with the house. Machara itstrobil, avalo etekelet, similar to our Mishnah, he sells the itstrobil, which was all the different things we described before, but the either base stone or the lower millstone, and not the kelet, which is either the hopper or the upper millstone or the capture mechanism, avalo etatanur, avalo etekiraim, avalo etereichaim, and not the oven and the stove and the mill. Now, either here you have to say that the reichaim is a smaller reichaim than the itstrobil and kelet that we mentioned before, if you think those are the millstones. Or you have to say that the itstrobil and the kelet are something different, and Rechaim refers to the two different millstones that are there. But in any of these cases, those are not included with the sale. Rabbi Elazar Omer, kol hamechubar lekarka, harei hu kikarka. Rabbi Elazar says, anything that's attached to the ground belongs to the ground. And the way that the Rishbam explains it over here, that Rabbi Elazar will be the author of our Mishnah, because he says, anything that's mechubar lekarka gets sold with the ground, and that would be the case by the Machteshet HaKvua. Unlike the Tanakama, he believes that that will get sold with the house, and that is similar to our Mishnah. If he uses a catch-all phrase and says that he's selling the house and everything in it, like our Mishnah, everything that we excluded over here now becomes included, because that extraneous language means that he's including more than what normally would come with the house, and that means anything that's utility is normally associated with the house. Benkach u benkach, no matter whether he says it as a default and sells the house, whether he sells the house in a default manner, or he specifies that he's selling the other items, lo machar, lo et abor, velo et adot, velo et yitziah. These items are not included in the sale of the house that we've already seen in the previous Mishnah, which is that the bor and the dot are considered to be different, differentiated utility, as well as a differentiated space from the house, and therefore they're not included in the sale. And the yitziah, depending on how we explained the word yitziah before, as we saw on the first daf of the parak on Samach Aleph on Aleph, that the Mishnah says, "Machar to bayit, lo machar to yitziah," and a filip tuchal le tocho. And the Gemara asked, "My yitziah? What is a yitziah?" And we had all the different explanations, both the machloket amoraim as to whether it was a afta or a bidka chalila, and then we had the machloket rishonim as to what the afta and the bidka chalila were. But in the end, we noted that it was something that had differentiated utility from the house, as well as the fact that it possibly could have been a freestanding item that is away from the house, or even if it wasn't, it was something that had access to the house, but was beyond the perimeter of the house. Tan Rabbanan, the Gemara here quotes a Tosefta from Mikvaot, Zinor Shechakuko Ublesov Kavo. If he had a pipe, which was first carved out and then afterwards placed or attached to the ground, poselet the mikveh. It ruins the mikveh. Kavo, if he affixed the pipe to the ground first in its state, not as a pipe, but as a solid piece of material, whether that's wood or kli cheres, it was sov chakako, and then it carved it out afterwards, ain't it poselet the mikveh, then it does not ruin the mikveh. Or in essence, what the Breita is saying is that there's a distinction between whether something was first attached to the ground and then carved out in the ground versus a case where it was first made into a kli and then attached to the ground. But what you see here from the Breita is something that got a designation as a kli beforehand and then is attached to the ground doesn't lose its designation as a kli. It remains a kli, and that means that it's not classified as being mechuber the karko. And the Gemara says, Mani, who's the author of disposition, lo Rabbi Eliezer velo Rabbanan. Neither Rabbi Eliezer nor the Rabbanan can be the authors of disposition. We'll discuss that statement of the Gemara in a second. Just to understand what's going on in the Tosefta and Mikvaot, there is a din with regards to a mikveh that the water of a mikveh must come from natural sources. That means that it either must come from rainwater or it must come from a live spring and then be put into an ashboren, into a collection area where the water is stationary. But you may not fill the water with drawn water or man-made water. The difference between water or rainwater and man-made water is how it gets into the capture mechanism. If it gets into the capture mechanism naturally, that means whether the rain falls directly into the capture mechanism or the water flows on the natural surfaces into the capture mechanism, that's considered to be rainwater. It's kosher the mikveh. On the other hand, if the water is brought there through kelim, kelim can be in one of two ways. One, that you draw water and you bring it to the mikveh. Or the other possibility is that you have kelim that you've now put into the ground, like pipes that take the water to the mikveh. That will be posel the mikveh because of a din of mayim shuvim. Mayim shuvim are drawn waters that are posel the mikveh. They're actually a machloket vishonim as to when mayim shuvim ruins a mikveh. The Rashbam brings over here, and the Shita of Rashi in some places in Shas, is that even when a mikveh has 40 sa'ah and is a completely kosher mikveh, if you have shlosh lugim, 3 lug worth of mayim shuvim, it can be posel the mikveh. Most Rishonim, on the other hand, believe that when it comes to a mikveh kshera, about 40 sa'ah, mayim shuvim can't affect it at all, no matter how much in the way of mayim shuvim that you bring into the mikveh. And that's the way that the modern day mikvot work, which is that they have a bore that contains the rainwater, and then they keep bringing in mayim shuvim, and that mayim shuvim they attach through neshika, that is, mitahara, makes it into a kosher mikveh. But rather, they believe that if the mikveh is not kosher yet, and then mayim shuvim fall into it, then the mayim shuvim can cause a problem for the mikveh. So now what we have to determine is whether the water coming into this mikveh is mayim shuvim. That'll be determined as to whether the water is flowing freely over the ground into the mikveh, or it's coming through a kli. And what the Breita says over here, the difference would be whether the pipe was first put in as a solid piece and then carved into the ground, or the equivalent of a natural surface that's made into a pipe. It was never a kli. It's considered to be a part and parcel of the ground, and therefore the water flowing in there is not classified as mayim shuvim. On the other hand, if the pipe was made beforehand and then placed into the ground and the water flows through the pipe into the mikveh, then that's going through a kli and will be classified as mayim shuvim. That's what the Breita says. The reason that a pipe is classified as a kli, the way that the Rashbam says it over here, is because the pipe itself is classified as a kli. The Balei HaTosafot point out over here that that's not so clear, because a pipe does not have what's called a beit kibul. It has to have a receptacle of sorts. Something's only classified as a kli if it has a receptacle as a toch to it where it captures water. And that's not true of a pipe. A pipe is open on both ends. The water flows through it freely. There is no beit kibul. According to the Rashbam, it's sufficient that the pipe itself is shaped in a manner that the water can sit inside, even though it's not trapped inside by the other ends. The Balei HaTosafot require that it be actually surrounded on all four sides. Even if one side of the pipe was closed up, that would not be sufficient to make it into a kli. You would have to have both sides of the pipe closed up. Now, obviously here, we're talking about a pipe. We're not talking about a full pipe. We're talking about a half pipe, which is an open top, and the semicircle is carved into whatever you put there or was made before and then placed in. So the Balei HaTosafot say that along this pipe, there's actually a dip in the pipe, which captures the rocks and other things that are flowing through. Or in essence, it is a trap that is built into the pipe that the water flows through, but the water is able to come out of the trap, but heavier items like stones and rocks aren't able to come out of that trap, and they get trapped there, and then they're cleaned out. And that's why there is a Beit Kibul, why this is a problem of a Kli here, is because of that little trap that's in the middle of the pipe that stops more sod materials from going into the mikveh. The water also flows through there, and therefore that's classified as a Kli, and that is the problem over here. The Gemara says that who is the author of this Braita? It's not Rabbi Eliezer, and not the Rabbonan. So the Gemara wants to know, hey, Rabbi Eliezer, and as the Rashbam points out, you could have asked, hey, Rabbonan. Which Rabbanan are we speaking about, and which Rabbi Eliezer are we speaking about? But the Gemara, in a shorthand, just said, which Rabbi Eliezer are we speaking about, where you're saying that Rabbi Eliezer and his Baal Plukta, the Rabbanan, both cannot fit into this Braita. Ilema Rabbi Eliezer de Bayit, if you say it's Rabbi Eliezer of the Braita that we just brought before with regards to Macharet HaBayit, when he sells the house, what is included or not is included, there we can understand at least why Rabbi Eliezer would not be the author of this Braita. Because Rabbi Eliezer in that Braita said before that a machteshet, if you have a mortar that is attached to the ground, it becomes a part and parcel of the house. It becomes mechuber, the karka, and is sold with the house. Over here, where you take a pipe and then you place it into the ground or fix it to the ground, it remains a kli according to the Tosefta and Mikvot. So we can understand why Rabbi Eliezer doesn't fit into that Tosefta in Mikvot. But as far as the Rabbonon, here you have a machloket between the Rashbam and the Balei HaTosafot. The Rashbam over here says, with regards to the position of the Chachamim, Miu Rabbanan de Pligele, Lo Lahavihanu Rabbanan, Demar Le'el, Lo Larbi Ezer, Velo Rabbanan. That over here, the Rabbanan over here, that are mentioned in the Braita that we had with the Machloket at Bachar at Abayit, those Rabbanan, in essence, could be the authors of this case in Mikvot. And therefore, when it says Lo Rabbanan over here, it means that not these Rabbanan, but some other Rabbanan. So the Gemara is only telling you that Rabbi Eliezer wouldn't have been able to fit into this Braita. But in Nachanami, the Rabbanan would have been able to fit in. So the Lo Rabbanan is going to reference to some other position of the Rabbanan. That's the way the Rashbam learns it. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot and the Rabbeinu Gershom both say that the Lo Rabbanan over here means also the Rabbanan of the Braita would not fit in. And that is because of a distinction in the way that they explained Chakuka and Kavua before. The way that the Rashbam explained it was that he distinguishes between Chakuka and Kavua in the following manner. The Rashbam says that Chakuka means that it was attached to the ground and then carved out. Kavua means it was first made and then attached to the ground. And that distinction would actually match what's found in the Tosefta Mikvot. But the Balei HaTosafot and the Rabbeinu Gershom say that's not the case. Chakuka and Kavua can mean different things. Chakuka could mean that it was carved into the bedrock. Kavua could be whether it was attached and then carved out, or carved out and then attached. And given that, even the Rabbonon would not fit into the Braita Tosefta from Mikvot, because they believe there's no distinction between whether you have first carved it out and then put it in the ground, or put it in the ground and then carved it out. They think neither of those are classified as Mechuber the Karka. It's only when you carve it into the bedrock that is have a din of Kavua la Karka. And so given that, even the Rabbonon would not fit in, and this would work out perfectly. It's not Rabbi Eliezer, it's not the Rabbonon, because they both can't fit into the Tosefta and Mikvot. Gemara says, that's not necessarily true. Dilma hainu taimi de Rabbi Eliezer. Maybe there's a distinction between the cases, that the reason why Rabbi Eliezer savar mocher ba'ain yafa mocher, and Rabbanan savri mocher ba'ain ra'a mocher, that has to do with their view vis-a-vis the seller over here. And therefore, by the case of mocher et abayit, the governing principle is not about attached to the ground, mechuber the bayit, not mechuber the bayit. These are items that are somewhat in between, and therefore we have to look at the intent of the seller. And whether the seller sells in a generous manner or he doesn't sell in a generous manner. Rabbi Eliezer says he sells in a generous manner. And therefore, things that are kavua, that are attached to the ground, even though they may not be classified as mechuber the karka for tuma or for mikvaot, nevertheless, they would be mechuber the karka vis-a-vis the sale because people sell behind yafa. And the chachamim the other way around. When they say that it's not classified as mechuber the karka, that may be unique to a case of mechira. But with regards to mikvot, maybe they would have a din of mechuber the karka if it was placed in the ground first and then carved out. And so therefore, their opinion by macharet habayit may not be synonymous with the same position that's found in mikvot, and maybe they could agree to that which is said in mikvot. So that can't be the lo rabbanan and lo rabbi Eliezer that the Gemara stated with regards to the authorship of that Tosefta from mikvot. Vela rabbi Eliezer de kaveret devorim. Rather, we have to say that it's Rabbi Eliezer that comes from the beehive or the honeycomb. We're going to see here from the Rishonim was attached to the ground. And given that it was attached to the ground, it gains a certain status of karka. And then that would be the Rabbi Elazar and the Chachamim that we say are not the authors of that position in the Tosefta of Mikvaot. And that is the Tanan. Kverita Dvorim, when it comes to this honeycomb or beehive that is attached to the ground, plastered into the ground, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Harihi Kekarko. It has a din like Karko. Over here you can see the Bali Tosafot, the Rashbam. No, Kekarko means that it has a din in terms of kinyanim, like karka. Therefore, the Mishnah Kiddushin that says karka's nickname bish kesef shtar v'chazaka would be applicable to this item, and it'd be acquired in the standard ways that a karka are acquired. V'kot v'nalea puzbol, and you can write on it a puzbol. There is a requirement, the Gemara says, in Gitin, with regards to the institution of puzbol, that they only instituted puzbol when there was karka underlying the loan. And that is for one of two reasons, as the Rashbam points out over here. Either because they only mitakein the din of Pruzbol to help out lenders and protect their loans when Shmitat Kesafim came about, when it was a standard type of loan. And a standard loan is a loan that is done with collateralized with karka, with underlying property. And since the individual did it in a normal fashion, and that's a regular type of loan, and was worried about getting repaid, and therefore he collateralized the loan, then we instituted the Takanah Pruzbol for him. Or the other reason being that we look at it as if collected. The whole function of the way that Pruzbol works, again, this is more details in the Sugya Pruzbol itself, but just in a general expression, it is that the Pruzbol functions to make it as if collected. Whether that means that Beit Din is now the ones collecting it on your behalf, or we view it as collected because there's underlying collateral to it, and therefore there's no ghosts, that the person's not pressing for repayment, because he has the collateral that will allow him for the repayment, or he's given it over to Beit Din, who will do the collection on his behalf, and therefore there will be no legos. For that reason, they needed karkor, they needed some underlying collateral to institute the kind of Pruzbol. So here too, this would be classified as karka. If the borrower, the debtor, had this as his karka, that would suffice to write a takanat Pruzbol on that karka. Ve'ina mikabalet tuma bimkoma. While it's attached to the ground, it is not mekabel tuma, because it has a status of karko. As the Rashbam says, as long as it's ibim koma, the honey is batel to the comb, and therefore it's mekabel tuma. But the honey, once it's taken out of the comb and it's moved away from that, then it has a din of being of ochel, and it is mekabel tuma, because it's no longer classified as being mechubar the karko. Varodemi menu b'shabbat, someone who scrapes out the honey from it on Shabbat, Chayav Chatat, is in violation of the Isur of Kotzer on Shabbat, which means detaching or tolesh something from the ground that is attached to the ground. And here too, the beehive is classified as being attached to the ground, and therefore the scraping out of the honey is considered to be the malocha of Kotzer. Chachamim Orim, Eina Kekarka. Chachamim say that it does not have the status of Karka. Therefore, just like you can't make kinyanin like it is karka, so too, ain't kodvin alea pruzbo, umekabela tuma, since it is metaltalin, therefore will have a din of tuma, or the ochel that is associated will have a din of tuma, umekabela tuma bimkoma, verodemi menu b'shabbat patur, and one who scrapes out honey from it on Shabbat is not chayav echatat, they are asur, meaning that there's an isur derabanan to do such, but midoraita, there is no isur, because you're not detaching it from something that is part attached to the ground, not tolesh, min amichubar. You're not detaching something that is attached, and therefore you're not in violation of the Isur of Shabbat. So the suggestion over here is, again, that this would be lo Rabbi Eliezer, lo Chachamim. It won't be Rabbi Eliezer, because Rabbi Eliezer says if you take an item like a kaveret and attach it to the ground, then it has a status like karka, which the Tosefta says by mikvot, that if you took a pipe and then attached it to the ground, it would still maintain the shame kli. Now the Rashbam says over here that it would be like the sheet of the Rabbanon over here. They would be the authors of that Tosefta in Mikvaot. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, "Velo Rabbanon he dam reina kekarka ubrayta ketani kavu b'lesof chakako enu poselat mikveh alma de karka dami." So here, the same difference that we saw between the Rashbam and the Bali Tosfot and the Rabbeinu Gershom before plays out here as well, which is that the Rabbeinu Gershom says that the Rabbanon here also think that it's not kekarka. Doesn't matter how you attach it to the ground. It doesn't have a din of karka. Whereas the Braita and Mikvot seems to differentiate between the cases. Sometimes it is like a kli, sometimes it is like karka. The Rabbanon over here make no such distinction, and therefore it could not follow the Rabbanon either. So it would be neither like Rabbi Lezer nor like the Rabbanon according to the Rabbeinu Gershom. According to the Rashbam, it wouldn't be like Rabbi Lezer, but the Chachamim could fit into that position over there, because he thinks the case over here is a case where the kaveret was attached to the ground afterwards, and therefore that would be differentiated from the case in mikvaot, and they might agree to the case where it was mechubar, and then the sof chakako, that would have a status of karka. The Gemara says again, hotam kedama Rabbi Lazar taimo. The reason over there is not because of what you're thinking in Rabbi Lazar's position has to do with the din of karka or not karka, depending if you're attached or not. Damar Rabbi Lazar, my time with the Rabbi Lazar. What is the reasoning behind Rabbi Lazar's position in this Mishnah? Dichti vaitbol otav v'yarot tadvash, that he dipped it into the honey of the forest. This is the story by Shaul and Yonatan when they're fighting the Plishtim, and his father Shaul says that nobody is allowed to eat that day. Yonatan was not present at the time that his father Shaul says that, and he goes through the forest and finds this delicious honey and ends up eating it. And he's then covered by the cherim, and then they come back, and later on, they draw lots to see who violated the cherim, and it turns out to be Yonatan, and Shaul wants to kill Yonatan for violating the cherim, and the people save Yonatan because of his tremendous exploits and successes in the battle there, that it must have been Yad Hashem, and he hadn't been there, he hadn't heard about the restriction of his father. When he does hear about it, he thinks that it's wrong, and he mentions that as well, so that also creates some of that friction between him and his father. But what you see here, as the Gemara says, Mayar hatolesh mimenu b'Shabbat chayav chatat, just like a forest, when you detach something from it on Shabbat, that's considered to be tolesh minem chubar, avdavash, rodem mimenu b'Shabbat chayav chatat. So too, or similarly, when someone scrapes the honey out of a honeycomb, it has a din of taking or tolesh minem chubar. And so what the Gemara answers is that the honeycomb has a unique status because of this hekesh that is made in Shmuel Aleph between a forest and a honeycomb. And that would explain all the other items as well. The Baal Tosafot in the previous Amud point out that there are many other problems with the assumption of the Gemara here, that Rabbi Lezer believes that the whole din of this kaveret has to do with Mechuber the Karka. And the Gemara could have asked many other questions, but in the end it got to a fundamental difference where it shows that he doesn't believe that it has to do with the din of Mechuber the Karka, but it's a unique din in a honeycomb, which is the hekesh between the honeycomb and the forest. And therefore all these dinim apply because of that. The Gabei Shabbat, for sure, is considered to be Tolesh Minem Chubar. And as the Rishonim point over here, the Rashbam points out over here, at this point we're assuming that it wasn't plastered into the ground. This is a Stam honeycomb. Because of this Hekesh, has this din, whether or not it's attached to the ground, it is classified as being something that is Mechubar Lekarko. And that's the same reason it's not Mekabel Tuma, because it's a din of Mechubar Lekarko, even though it is Metaltel. The Balei HaTosafot ask over here if that's the case. Why is it Mekabel Tuma when it's not in its place? It doesn't have anything to do with being in place or not in place. So if you follow the Rashbam's position, then you can understand why Bimkoma, because it's dealing with the honey and not the comb itself. On the other hand, if you're dealing with the comb, or maybe even the honey, the Baal Tosafot offer another alternative explanation as to why it's only not Mekabel Tuma Bimkoma, but it is Mekabel Tuma Shalom Bimkoma. And therefore the Baal Tosafot say that the reason it's Mekabel Tuma when it's not in place is a Gzerat Chachamim, because it looks like metalkalim, and therefore they gave it a din of tuma. But otherwise, or technically, it would have been tahor, because it has a classification of being mechubar the karka. And the same is true with regards to the pruzbol and the din of kinyanim, that has a classification of karka because it's compared to a forest. And just like a forest is deemed to be karka, so too in this case. But that means that all of these dinim, in Rabbi Lezer's opinion, are unique to a kaveret devorim, but it's not something that you could extrapolate to other places. And maybe Rabbi Lezer would have a different opinion outside of this particular issue. And therefore, he could possibly have been the author of that position in the Tosefta and Mikvaot. And then you can't say that this is below Rabbi Lezer, below Rabbonat. There, neither of them are the authors of that position, because the machloket here is a unique machloket, the Kveret Dvarim, that you can't apply to Mikvaot. Okay, we're going to stop here. 9 lines down on the top of Samach Vav and Aleph. And the Gemara will continue tomorrow trying to discover or find the Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim, who have an opinion that makes it that they cannot be the authors of that Tosefta and Mikvaot.